Okay, this is part two of our insight sessions on topical issues in group insurance. So welcome today. The insight sessions are brought to you jointly by the Life Insurance and Wealth Management Practice Committee and the Superannuation Practice Committee. And a special thank you goes to Richard Land, who's done all the organising for these, but who can't be here today, so I've taken his place. Oh, and my name's Jeff Humphreys from the Super Practice Committee. Today we have a special panel of three distinguished guests speaking to us to share their insights on the topic. Our first speaker today is Greg Staunton. He's the head of product and pricing at QInsure, Australia's newest life office, and was integral to the project to establish QInsure. Greg has over two decades in group insurance industry working for insurers, super funds and consultants. He's never far from change. And we have Andrew Gill, Managing Director of Pacific Life Re. Andrew is a qualified actuary with experience in life insurance in various roles, ranging from appointed actuary to business development and marketing. He's worked in a variety of markets, including US, UK, Asia, and, of course, Australia. And last but not least, Daniel Stone is Senior Portfolio Actuary in TAL's group pricing area. He's had over 14 years of experience working for insurers and as a consultant. He's worked in a wide range of fields, and he's now responsible for TAL's group data analytics, portfolio analysis, client insights, claims analytics, and developing innovative pricing approaches across TAL's portfolio. So we'll kick off with Greg. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeff. About 5 years ago, I was talking at a part of a different panel session talking about changes or the future of group life, and the chairman opened up with a question to me and said, "Greg, so when will industry funds set up its own life company?" He said that'll happen. And about that time, I fell off my seat because Ian Silk had said to me, "Greg, tomorrow I want to hear about or read about Australian Super setting up a life company." So I've got into trouble without talking. Fortunately, Peter Rowe was the vision super led over and said, "Greg, you didn't say that." So that saved me on that day. But 5 years on, I'm here now talking about how a major fund has come to set up its own life company. So I have to share that. And hope you have some questions afterwards. So. Am I going the right way? Yep. So we had two drivers. QSuper basically was faced with a situation where, under regulation, we needed to cease self-insurance by 30 June 2016. So, in essence, we had a split of insurance arrangements. All the government employees were basically self-insured, so we look after the state government employees in Queensland. And our retained members were typically outsourced to TAL under a separate outsourced arrangement. The other driver for us too at that time is, and what you will have been reading about in the papers, is that the Queensland state government was considering implementing choice of funds. So that led to us, a different scenario too about what kind of product we needed in an open fund environment. So we actually went through to a full product review as part of that situation. I think on Thursday there was some chat around us as well. And look, one thing that was clear in this process was, in fact, this was all about our members. And so our focus in delivering an insurance company has in fact been what was in our members' best interest. So we don't see ourselves as a competitor to other life insurers or entering the space of other super funds at this time. And there's nothing in our strategic horizons around that. Just on the slide there, there's a bit of our... Sorry, I've got to stay focused because I'm not allowed to look away. You don't hear me, apparently, on that front, but it's a bit hard to read as well. So, look, the blue boxes there on the slide, effectively those things are about QSuper looking at outsourcing its insurance arrangement under a traditional arrangement. And the red boxes, or brownie red boxes, are those steps that we're tied into effectively considering and then moving to implement our own life insurance company. So you can see through, we went through really a fairly extensive period. And we started this really in about December 2013. And we actually launched a life company and started writing our first policy on 1 July 2016. So it wasn't a quick process. It was a thorough and well thought out and investigated process to get there. Essentially, we had to look at our product design. About February 2014, we did our first initial business case, and Ross Warner helped us with that. Looking at the pros and cons of life insurance external versus set up at home. And the conclusion out of that was there was merit, and there were definitely strengths and weaknesses though, and it was still at high level. At the same time, we commenced the process having designed our product, and our product design was really led by effectively our own members' best interests, notwithstanding we're looking at an open fund scenario in that respect. So we finally got to a position where we had our desired product, and we did start our first external RFP process. So we went to market, and there was a lot of interest. About six to ten insurers had expressed interest. Six gave us initial, expressions of interest. But the outcome, in essence, was we only had one non-binding proposal. And what was emerging was significant market issues, which I think most people across the group life market was having trouble in capacity, particularly at the reinsurance level. And QSuper is actually a lot bigger than people think. So the insurance arrangement was about $360 million at that time. And there are no insurers that will typically write that without reinsurance support. So we had three reinsurers basically shut to new business at that time. And so we're unable to get, in fact, a binding proposal. Off the back of that, we did move to do a more detailed business case, and it overlaps. And these steps are kind of concurrent and sometimes overlapping through that process. So, and we engaged KPMG, who did our core work there through an RFP process, and went through that process as well. And by December 2015, I guess we had the detailed business case, and we'll step through a little bit more of that later. And then at the same time, while we had no binding proposals, we had two insurers expressing interest in our arrangements, and we felt that we should be making that every endeavour to see if we could place that business out into the market. So we, in fact, went through a fairly thorough process working with the two insurers engaged to see if we could adjust any design issues, work with their reinsurers or potential reinsurers to try and create that capacity. And off the back of that, we did tweak some product adjustments, and we were able then to move into a formal RFP process. We had full transparency, which I think was key through here, around, our pricing, where we're going, what our design was, what was our strategy, and we shared that. And we found that the insurers were quite open to sharing that same information back with us. Unfortunately, that RFP, again, kind of was unsuccessful getting to where we want to, and I'll step you through, how we got to the decision on that one. And by July 2015, we in fact went to the QSuper board and proposed that the right way forward was to in fact establish QInsure as a separate subsidiary life company. From there, we really went into operationalising it. So we had from July 2015 to really try and be outsourced to a new life company by 30 June 2016 to meet the regulatory requirements. So there's a fairly big task to achieve in a fairly short time. So through there, we had to design the organisational design and establish the company. That was the first stage. Really, by September 2015, we in fact submitted our first licence application, our AFSL licence application. In December 2015, APRA came in and did an internal review of our capabilities, and that was a really useful step for us. That showed, all the areas they were looking for from us to perhaps enhance or be stronger in, and that became one of our key platforms to identify what were the things we methodically worked through and adjust. So by April 2014, we had started that process and we'd identified those gaps and basically we're closing out and we're able to submit our revised licence application. And by May 2016, in fact, our licence was approved, which was, a phenomenal outcome that effectively was from the initial application in September to May. It was about 8 months and we've got through that process. And the fund was quite excited to achieve that. I think it was probably the fastest application process that happened today. And really then, from July 2016, we went live. So, and that brought forward, a whole new product, and also combined the previous external insurance arrangements and also the self-insurance arrangements under QInsure. What drove us, though, really was that test, members' best interests, is key. And obviously, SIS requires that at two levels. One, around what insurer we do select, and needs to be at arm's length, any members' interest, and also how we invest. And so obviously we need to put substantial capital into to QInsure, and to justify that also needed to meet that best interest test. How do we interpret best interest though? I guess in that sense, the board has 8 design principles sitting over top of its product and insurance arrangement, and below that we had 4, I guess, themes that were developed, which were really objectives to its insurance arrangement. And that could be summarised up into really the product design and supporting strategic objectives. And our core objective is retirement adequacy. So our product was being designed for that purpose. And we wanted to deliver that product that we had designed. The other aspect was it needed to be value for money, and it needed to be sustainable and stable, which is the key element that we're driving to. And that was, a lot of the changes coming through to the product were in fact designed to support that. Another key element is, QSuper has a really strong member-centric focus. Its services are benchmarked very well in the market, and in fact, relative to our peers, we're quite a long way ahead in our claims management time to make decisions. So we pay members their money on time when the benefits are due, and we didn't want to see those kind of services compromised. In fact, we want to keep building upon that if we can. And in looking at our overall services and our insurance model, we wanted to look at ways we could bring really the member, the employer, the fund, the insurer and reinsurer closer together, make that a more aligned and straightforward process, delivering simple services but effective, but not compromising appropriate risk controls. In summarising up though, how we tested out was the product and provider, how would we assess those, and really what was that member return to justify injecting the capital. So we looked at insurers versus QInsure, and QInsure obviously didn't exist at this stage, although we had the product and how we anticipated operating on that front. So, we looked at a risk assessment, and we looked at, the capital positions, and we ticked off that all parties would meet that requirement. QInsure was going to be capitalised at a strong position, and on capital adequacy ratios was in fact higher relative to the other insurers, but other insurers probably had larger portfolios, so it's more about being satisfied at that sense. Where QInsure looked stronger was, in fact, takeover terms. One of the big issues in the market often in changing insurers is potential gaps there. And obviously, QSuper trusted itself to close out those gaps, in essence. And client conflicts is another place. Obviously, in an open fund environment, we're competing with other funds who may be looking for our employers or potentially we may grow other employers. And often come with external insurance rates is that the insurer has other major clients on board. And so there are conflicts of interest as to what can be offered. So that was seen as a strength. Product features and terms. Well, QInsure was obviously fully supporting its product that QSuper was seeking, yet we did have limitations coming through from a number of insurers, particularly around one of our core groups, the police. Now, obviously, there's the view New South Wales Police has had many issues in terms of its insurance arrangement. That was filtering through into what insurers were prepared to do for QSuper. We obviously had the Queensland Police. So we saw restrictions around definitions, automatic acceptance limits and things coming through, and that was seen as obviously deficient in that area. Service approach, I guess we saw all the insurers wanting to support where we're going and how we do it. One of the insurers, in fact, had clearly a superior technology proposition around needs analysis straight through proposals. So, QInsure wasn't seen as the strongest proposition there. Notwithstanding, it did see itself very strong in its claims management approach. That kind of came through in that element. What we found was, in fact, the return to work participation rates. We looked at, our core delivery of products for an income protection product as well as TPD, and we looked at the return to work rates being achieved by the insurers, and in fact, both the external insurers' participation return to work programs for their open income protection plans was less than half of that of QSuper's. So that was seen as a very material area when we can consider the risk attached to perhaps some claims blowing out if return to work fall away. The other area too was just our speed to delivery. So on average, an income protection claim in QSuper is determined within 13 days of notification to the fund. And what we saw with insurers was it was more than double that and often triple that before a decision would get made. So that risk to member services was a key element for us. And likewise on TPD, QSuper's ability to determine its claims is much quicker. Yet we see the decline rates are very comparable. So what plays out is QSuper has a very strong relationship with its employers and also its members. It enables the information to be transferred and gathered fairly quickly. Obviously, moving to external arrangement was bringing risk to that element as well. Claims management, we talked about a lot. We had existing claims management capability. Obviously, QSuper saw its claims management being fully aligned to its philosophy and approach. We did open audits with both the external insurers and reinsurers as well, looked at our claims management, and we also went in and looked at their claims management. We did find stronger alignment with one insurer than another, but clearly we felt QSuper understood its strategy and was more aligned naturally to deliver that. Pricing was an interesting one. We did see a material difference there, and we had spent, as I said earlier, a lot of time in open discussions and workshops on this front, sharing, I guess, the assumptions and the pricing. And we found about a 10 to 20% pricing differential in expected claims and accounting, obviously, for return on capital and expenses. So that was a fairly big deficiency for the insurers relative to QInsure. What we did see there was profit and share loss arrangements emerging. And so we did account for that into our pricing assessment. Obviously, if losses are going to be shared back to or taken on by the trustee in that process, then the pricing risk is really transferring back to the trustee. So we needed to account for that. And we looked at what kind of capital requirements we would need to maintain in order to deal with that. And you can really look to LAGIC as a pretty good guideline there, as those capital requirements are set pretty much for that purpose. So we took that kind of approach in looking at it. So in total, I mean, we did feel QInsure was the stronger proposition, given particularly the deficiencies on product side. You know, I guess the much stronger performance we had from a member-centric point of view on the claims management, ability to make those decisions, and there was a material pricing difference, which obviously in our members' interest we felt needed to be considered. It wasn't the only considerations, though. Again, as I said, KPMG had been engaged and over several months did a full business case investigation for us. And some of the findings out of there, so they looked at financial and strategic kind of positions as well as service positions. Essentially, some of the findings were effectively the QInsure proposition did require enhancement of core capabilities in order to deliver, but it had a core existing capability that was there. And it had a history of being able to, I guess, move into new regimes. We'd had launched other subsidiaries and we'd changed regulatory environments before along the way. We did look at investment returns. We looked at from a zero kind of approach to a full commercial terms. And we asked KPMG to undertake that work and look at, well, what was the performance of the industry over time in that sense. And so we did look to what was the normal commercial return for a life company in setting up the business. And one of the learnings there, in fact, if you went a zero return on capital, as soon as you grow, you'll have to inject new capital. So you've got to get that kind of balance right as well and think about the future capital requirements. Given the loss transfer arrangements, we're seeing profit transfer as well. Really, the pricing risk was still going to sit with the trustee in an external environment. Whereas if QInsure was established, it was quarantined within QInsure. So in essence, I guess the risk profile was similar, potentially more stable in the sense that the subsidiary was retaining the full risk relative to external insurers. It does give us the ability to take a longer-term view and not to be influenced so much by short-term market changes that have perhaps occurred over recent years. So that's an advantage, I guess, that we're seeing in that process. And also reduce market constraints. Obviously, with an external insurer, if you're looking to do something different, then you're into a negotiation, whereas in a QSuper group approach, then you've got an aligned strategy and less constraints on that front. Does that make sense? So once we've made that decision, though, there's still a lot to do, in effect. If you drop to the second and third points, we had to establish the company, a new board. One of the key elements we did was establish an independent board, and that was deliberate to ensure, manage that, I guess, conflicts issue as well. And the trustee still has its obligations to continue to manage and make sure that the insurance is the appropriate value for members, and it will retest and test relative to market from time to time to ensure QInsure is delivering that value. Board policies and guidelines was a massive piece of work. While there was existing capability and existing policies, we were now splitting, I guess, QSuper kind of into two. We had a self-insurance arrangement that had 20 years of experience. We had a lot of claims management capability. We had policies and we had guidelines and approach. But now we had the trustee still needing to continue its function and also establish a life company that would effectively be independent. And so we did have to split elements of that and work out which resources went where, and the trustee has maintained essentially oversight on its claims management with a team, product, and also pricing, and also on the underwriting front. Yet we have also looked at creating efficiencies through where could dual hatting or functions be dual hatted, but within those functions perhaps have some dedicated QInsure resources. I guess the risk appetite stakes and all those things were there. Conflicts was... that's not a good sign. I can keep talking, but really that whole operation was a massive piece of work, and that short time I was called out earlier as a big risk, and APRA signaled that to us as a big risk from their perspective as well, and it was a shared entity. And as a startup, we didn't have an insurance policy, and while we had policies to other insurers, we had to create all those legal contract service agreements from one, so it's a lot of work to happen. And it's the... So how do we get there? It really was a strong project management and change management framework, and Peter Tamuth, who's kind of hiding in the audience today, has moved on from QSuper in Sydney, so anybody looking for somebody who's got massive output and strategic thinking and can really drive a coordinated project, you should look up Peter. But it really was the key to success. We had a dedicated team of three, but working out with groups amongst the whole business in that process. And we had great people. And really, from the top to the bottom, we needed everyone to come together. So we had the chiefs giving us clarity and clearing the decks in other projects to enable us to move forward. And in fact, clearing time to review board papers. So our board paper cycles were typically 3 weeks. We're often moving through in 1 to 2 week kind of pieces. And it was only through that support that we were able to bring resources and people to hand. And we had a lot of people doing extra hours, but it was coordinated and everybody was involved. But we couldn't do that on our own, so we obviously needed external help, and we again engaged KPMG to support us through the licensing process and the operational setup. And we had brought other consultants along the way. Ruth Keeney helped us a lot on the underwriting claims guidelines that needed to be built out. Along the way, we had several external legal advisors, including Thompson Greer, tax advice, and all those components to bring it together. But one of the real keys, I guess, was working closely with APRA and ASIC along the way. And we'd been working closely with APRA from, I guess, mid-2014 when we went to the first RFP. We shared with them what we were doing. We knew we had a 2-year horizon at that stage to see self-insurance. And we knew the market had issues. So we engaged them in that process, and we gave them updates regularly on where we're going and what we're seeking to do on product, how the RFP was going, how we had an unsuccessful RFP outcome, what we're going to try to do to get past that. Our clear preference was to externally insure if we could, but at the same time we kept it across that we were exploring the external, setting up our own life company in essence as an alternate option. So by the time we got to July 2015 and we were making that call, they fully understood why and what the reasons were. And then we had tried everything, I guess, to try and get to the position we were. And there were elements that we weren't prepared to compromise in our members' interests. So the decision was made to head towards our own life company. And we're now convening down that track. So they worked closely with us. Obviously, we felt the bar was set high. But they responded quickly to the things we did and gave us clarity. And we worked on the premise of we weren't uncomfortable with a high bar because that meant we would be better. And so we drove hard to try and achieve the things they are looking from us as well along the way. The life companies and the reinsurers I wouldn't miss as well. Even while we were kind of in the RFP process, we deliberately shared with them, in fact, we were looking at our own life company as an alternate. And we found that sharing that with them, they seemed to be quite comfortable. In fact, we got a lot of help. They actually shared organisational design, they shared positions, descriptions, and they're quite open to the possibility that they may be unsuccessful, and they participated on that understanding. And essentially, we got the same kind of support from reinsurers and the like as well, and even support, particularly in SCORE, who we've appointed. I'll talk a little bit more about that. In supporting the, building our board policies, sharing information, and that helped a lot. What we focused on was really unnecessary and sufficient. To get live, we couldn't necessarily have a target operating model, so we worked out what was the minimum we needed to deliver, and we targeted towards that. One of the key elements we did decide on was to take up some reinsurance. We actually had the capacity to go without reinsurance. APRA encouraged us, and we sort of agreed that having a peer review of our product pricing was not a bad thing. And obviously it does deliver some capital efficiencies if you can transfer some of that risk. So we did go on the basis that, you know, if we could find appropriate commercial terms, and we knew there were other benefits in that area, such as we didn't have an underwriting manual, and we needed one of those, and reinsurers can supply that. And also they have access to substantial offshore research and other elements that could help us. So there were benefits to pursue that option. We did overlay that, though, with the capital strategic and operation. We wanted it to be a commercially beneficial arrangement for both parties. We didn't want to go into one and just offload some risk and then find, in fact, they're not aligned and we're going into massive negotiations every time we want to change something. So we're confident scores on board with where we're going, and that was a key element for us to assess along the way. What we did find was, I guess, score was and in fact, the reinsurers in general were more aligned to our pricing, so we had a range from -5 to +10 relative to our pricing, so in fact, there was discounts available relative to our pricing assessment, whereas we went back, I guess, 6 to 12 months earlier, it was a +10 to +20. So that was a clear benefit that came through that process. I mean, claims data had changed since then, so there may be elements behind that in assessment, but, you know, it gave us confidence in our pricing assessment that we had, I guess, the reinsurance market with a fairly similar view. And to be honest, three of them were in +5, -5. We had full product support from Score. We saw still variable support from other reinsurers, from low support to quite strong support, but 100% support from Score, which was a perfect outcome for us. We had strong alignment, again, on our underwritings and claims. So we shared all our underwriting guidelines, all our claims management guidelines, philosophies to all the parties. And we wanted to know if someone's going to buy in with our member-centric approach and how we move. And we spent time in workshops with each of the parties around that. And again, we got kind of full support from Score. And look, generally got strong support from all the reinsurers on that front. Where we did get some other differential, though, was on operational impact. So, again, Score bought in strongly to where we're going, what we're doing, and it goes quite high delegations, and so there's low operational impact and quite efficient, effective processes, whereas with some of the other reinsurers, we saw quite low delegations. It would have created a lot more operational impact to the business through that process. Obviously, underwriting manual and other services were a key element, but we've seen most of that from all the reinsurers in essence, so that was a fairly low differentiator there. So the key elements came around, I guess, that operational impact. Support of the product was the other key one, and just that overall alignment, I think, is absolutely key. So, and that comes through in each of those elements. If somebody's saying you're aligned, but then the operational impacts are significant because the delegations are low, you start to wonder about those things. So that'd be a message for people or reinsurers to think about kind of going forward. We held catastrophe cover, and we'd held that all along, even as a self-insured fund, and so we transferred that to QInsure and obviously reviewed it, giving consideration to all those things. So. In summary, the market forces did drive this outcome. Our first preference was, in fact, to outsource those arrangements to an external insurer. But a combination of those product, service, claims management kind of impacts risk to our members. And certainly that price was a key element there, and capability did kind of form a view. And I think it was a perfect storm market in some ways. So it'd be interesting if the market was much more competitive. The decision would have been harder, in essence, but it may have still played out. Some of the things that went well and also where the challenges were, I mean, the engagement at APRA and ASIC, I think, was obviously a key element to enable us to move through quickly and try and balance what they were seeking with what we needed to deliver. The business case did guide us, so that business case did identify the key, I guess, areas of issues and focus, and we're able to drive our operating structures and other elements to deliver those. And again, that strong project management kind of piece meant we were always planning ahead, and we did have assumptions of where we're going, and things did move around, but we'd already thought about, well, what if that plays out, how do we move? And that was a key element, particularly through the product development phase. We were trying to build and deliver a product, and we hadn't fully sourced it. And so we hadn't assumed product, but we had options that could change, and we kept thinking about how those contingencies played out and what we'd need to move. And that played out also in resource structures. So, you know, we needed to think about if we couldn't stand up all the resources, then underwriting was our big risk. We didn't have an underwriting capability in QInsure or QSuper. We had accepted all cover and basically on a pre-existing conditions exclusion and a short form in some cases. Yet the new product was bringing in underwriting for large risks. So we had to build that from scratch. So getting, when you go to recruit and you haven't got a license, that's a bit of a challenge because people are taking a risk to decide whether they'll come and join you. So you need to think those things through. And we did put contingency in place with the reinsurers, say in the event we couldn't stand up resources in time, would you come in place and help us with that? And we have found SCORE very helpful on that front. They have assisted us on the underwriting front with some additional capacity. Obviously, the strong internal program management was key. We did have all that support. That went well. And that transparency, I guess, across the board is really what helped us. I mean, the timeline was a significant challenge, but, you know, fortunately that came together. And again, and you know, I think Pete deserves a lot of credit in keeping us on track to deliver that with the executive. Managing competing priorities, we did see the executive step in and redirect certain priorities away so that we can make sure QInsure could get up and get going. We did regularly have different options running. We have QInsure, we have external insurer. What did that mean for a claims management team with 42 people plus support take to 70? They're potentially looking at a scenario where the funds cease self-insurance, and therefore what did that mean for them? Did that mean there was loss of jobs? So we kept communicating transparently around what we were doing, where we were going, and what were the options along the way. Duplication is a function and balancing that within independence and efficiency. So, you know, do we set up two total operations, two claims management teams, two product teams, two finance teams, two legal teams or not? And we looked at where could we get efficiency in that structure. And so there are a number of dual-hatted areas across finance and legal components where we have, I guess, a dual-hatted function, but we produce, dedicated pieces for each party. And we did deliver, I guess, independent claims manager oversight for both parties along the way to make sure we, you know, did maintain that independent trustee view. Have I eroded time? I think we're pretty much there anyway. So, looking forward to some questions afterwards.
Thanks, Greg. Well, it's interesting. We've got a diverse group of us here today. And interestingly, you get the front office view, the insurer view, or the trustee view in the case of Greg. And now we're going to the very back. We're going to the reinsurer. So the person is at the very end of the process, so to speak. So I'm going to talk just for 15 minutes or so just about reinsurance, the roles and challenges in the group insurance market. I think all of you will be very aware that it has been a pretty testing last 5 years, a bit of a roller coaster. And I wanted to give you thoughts from a reinsurer about some of the things that have gone on and some of the challenges to make sure that this doesn't happen again, basically. So I thought it might just be worth setting the scene. And we've got, obviously, we had a presentation here last week, three people talking about some of the challenges in the industry. We're going to talk about some of the challenges in the reinsurance industry. We're going to hear later about some of the challenges in data. But I think it's always worth reminding ourselves what the Australian group market is. And essentially, it's a challenging market. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't a challenging market. It's complex. There's a lot of different things going on, a lot of different people are covered, operationally complex, difficult for actuaries to price, difficult for actuaries to value. There's a lot of uncertainty. All the things that are going on in the press obviously adds to the complexity of that market. But it is efficient. It's got to be one of the most efficient insurance markets in the world. For a product where someone who puts a dollar worth of premium can get paid back on average 85 to 90 cents in that dollar, that's pretty good going. Compare that to the cost of, say, retail or direct business, where you'd be lucky if you got half that dollar back in some cases. The cost of actually distributing in group is so much cheaper, and it's a very efficient way of writing insurance. I couldn't think of a better word here, but it's almost more paternalistic. Now, we have a fantastic healthcare system here. We have a bit of a whinge about it sometimes, but compared to many other countries, it's very good. We've got the Medicare safety net, which Australians wouldn't get rid of at all costs. You saw that in the last election, discussions around Medicare, potentially changing Medicare. People don't want to change that. We serve the public good as well in the group insurance market. So we give tens of thousands of people benefits every year when a spouse dies or a partner dies or becomes TPD and can't work again. And essentially, the main point I want to say about this slide is that we really should be proud of what we do in the group industry. We're talking about some of the challenges here today, and I'll talk about some of them from a reinsurance perspective, but we do a lot of good. We just need to keep improving ourselves and keep building up our trust in the industry to make sure that it continues on the right track. So I'll get off my hobby horse and talk about reinsurance. So what is the role of reinsurance? Many of you may know, have worked with reinsurer, have dealt with reinsurers before. Many of you may have not dealt with reinsurers before. You're possibly the lucky ones. So it's changed over time. And I have, this is some APRA stats of profits in the group insurance market. Richard Land, who did a presentation the other day, had exactly the same graph, and I stole it from him. So one thing to bear in mind about the APRA numbers, they don't include losses made or profits made for externally retroceded business. So where the reinsurer takes on a risk and in most cases passes off to their parent. And some of those risks can be asymmetric depending on how the retrocession arrangement works. So the key point to note, really, that loss in 2013 is actually understated because a lot of those losses got sent overseas and aren't part of the APRA stats. Either way, it's a big number. But I've got a blue line in there, and I'm going to talk about two periods because the role of the reinsurer really has changed. And some of what Greg was talking about, almost he was talking about a before and after period, not being able to get any capacity in the market and coming back in a year's time and getting some capacity and some reasonableness in rates. But at the risk of me not being able to say the word apocalypse correctly, I'm going to refer to it as the pre-zombie period. And the pre-zombie period, if you will, was characterised by a lot of what, a very highly commoditised market. So price was really key in making decisions. There are a lot of things in the background, but price was really the driver of decision making. There was this perception that TPD experience was improving. It was often put it down to better occupational health and safety or improving economies, whatever you want to put it down to. There was this perception TPD was getting better and better. Increasing benefit levels, we know funds increased their covers. Stalled growth in traditional reinsurance markets. This is an interesting one in that you had a situation in Europe and North America where there wasn't much growth in insurance. And you had the situation in Australia, a first world country with a very efficient insurance market where the amounts of cover were just ballooning. Funds were doubling, tripling, quadrupling the size of their cover. But over the last 10 years up to 2015, the increase in the actual premiums written by reinsurers here is about 13% per annum. You could never find those increases in size in any of those other markets. So reinsurers, we're all in. Let's put the capital into the Australian market. Let's get some of this group business which has good experience, and not just that, improving experience. And you also have funds that are less engaged than they are now. So that's the pre-zombie period, if you will. The post-zombie period, let's say, is characterised by something very different. All these losses happened and characterised by a much greater value on sustainable terms. And a lot of what Greg was talking about related to that, for instance. Greg's focus on operational expertise, claims being a good one. There was a group insurance conference a few weeks ago, and claims, I think, was the first, or claims rehabilitation were really the first three presentations of that conference. Reviews of product definition changes. We've seen a lot of those in the market. Some of those have been mentioned in the media as well. The post-zombie period was a very tepid reinsurance market. We all know about that. Reinsurers not running TPD business or only running business on very restrictive terms at very restrictive rates. And also very engaged funds. So trustees of insurance funds in 2010 knew very little about insurance vis-a-vis their counterparts in 2016, who know that insurance is a big part of their offering. And if you get it wrong, you're going to have to send a difficult member out, a letter out to your members, trying to explain to them why their cover's increased or why their cover is premiums going up 70%, say. So there's really two periods, and the role of reinsurance is varying in those periods. So on the weekend I started trying to play around with PowerPoint, because I don't really know what I'm doing, so hopefully this comes out okay. But what I'm trying to list here is the role of reinsurers in the pre-zombie period and the post-zombie period. From least important, down the bottom of the slide, to the most important at the top of the slide. So if we took the pre-zombie period, we asked the question, what did insurers value from their reinsurers? Now, stop blank, there are things that are going to come up on the slide. So capital's an obvious one, right? So reinsurers generally are very, all Australian reinsurers have got credit ratings of AA- or above, right? So they're pretty capitally stable, they've got large overseas parents, and these funds are huge. Some of them are, Greg said, 360 million in the case of Q Super, it's even larger now. So some of these funds are talking about hundreds of millions of dollars of premium, or claims if you will, over a period of 2, 3, 4 years in some cases. So there's a lot of capital that's needed to back that, and reinsurers provide a lot of that capital in a company that's pretty capitally stable. But price competitiveness is the other big one. So if you're the insurer in a really price-driven market, you want to work with the reinsurer that's the most price competitive as well, because if price is the game, that's where you win or lose. You don't want to be with a reinsurer that's charging 10, 20% higher than anyone else. So price competitiveness was key in terms of any reinsurer proposition in that market. There are a number of other things, volatility management, which is pretty typical about all reinsurance. Pricing expertise and validation was important, but not as much as the price competitiveness, in my view. Claim support, once again, that's more along the lines of audits, making sure claims teams are working well. Probably wasn't the value-add claim support that we see more in the current market. Product support, again, products weren't changing too much, they're actually weakening terms as opposed to changing terms significantly. And finally, underwriting support. I hope there's no underwriters in the room, because underwriting support comes out the bottom of all these slides. So, no? Excellent. I hope there's no zombies in the room either, because So the post-zombie period. I'll change the question here. What do insurers and trustees value from their reinsurers? Because an interesting change happened. Rates went up quite considerably in many cases, and a lot of the time the blame is, at least in part, possibly even more than that, blame on the reinsurers. The reinsurers were, generally speaking, the first to put up their hand and say, look, there's a problem here, your rates are going up. The trustees often didn't know who their reinsurer was, let alone knew what their involvement was in the whole process. So rather than sitting in our ivory towers, if you will, the trustees wanted to see reinsurers, know who they are, know what their risk appetites look like, and so forth. And so reinsurers become part of a proposition an insurer brings, which is obviously beneficial to a reinsurer. So in the post-zombie world, capital is still very important. You still need to be very capitally stable, and that's still one of the things at the top of the list. But I think pricing expertise and validation moves up, and that's really to do with the sustainability of any sort of offering, right? And Greg mentioned a couple of these different types of offering. He mentioned profit loss shares. There's a number of different models out there to try and deliver more sustainable pricing and more sustainable outcomes, which is important for the industry to regain trust with trustees, its members, and so forth. So trustees and insurers now see this as much more important than it was before. Claim support is much more important. As I said earlier, that seminar I went to a few weeks ago, just the first three presentations on rehabilitation, getting people back to work, all these things weren't really part of the vernacular going back into the pre-zombie period, in a way. And so claims support and the quality of the claims teams is so important in terms of choosing a reinsurer now. I've put this in a different colour because it just probably wasn't really happening, experience monitoring. So going to the trustee during his, say, three-year rent guarantee period and saying, well, one and a half years in, things aren't looking particularly good. We need to do something to turn this around. Or things are going particularly good and you might be able to get a discount at the end of the 3 years. We just weren't open, we weren't transparent, we were very opaque in the way we dealt with trustees and with reinsurers with insurers. And they ended up giving us a black eye. So that's maybe much more than it was a number of years ago. Product support, change in TPD definition. I think a lot of you would have seen the Sun Super changes, for example, and the payment of TPD by installments. There's a whole gamut of different changes out there. So the ability for reinsurers who have a view of the whole market also have some independent views from overseas to be able to provide value-added insights into product support is seen as crucial by insurers and reinsurers in the new market. I wanted to put this a little higher because I don't want to downplay price competitiveness. You still need to be reasonably competitive on price. You still need to be able to not overplay trends one way or the other. It's still an important consideration, but it's a lot lower than it was before. Volatility management, just left there, basically. And again, I put underwriting support at the very bottom. I'm not saying underwriting is not important, but underwriting support, obviously, in the group market is not as important, say, for a retail proposition. So that's the role of reinsurance and how it's changed between the pre- and the post-zombie period. So it's a very different space. And one of the interesting things is where we'll end up with this. So we had a situation where the reinsurers, the role was really a price taker, going back until sort of 2013 or so, and moved more into the role of a value adder. Obviously there's some generalisations in there. Some reinsurers and some arrangements were able to be not just price takers or value adders, but the role of the reinsurance I see has got to be more of that value add proposition as opposed to just being a price taker or throwing prices out there, if you will. So the challenge for reinsurers, this is probably going off the last slide, but I think the one thing you see commonly in any reinsurance market, and most insurance market, are cycles, right? So cycles are very common in general insurance markets, for instance. Cycles are very common in things like airline industry, for example. And cycles are really driven when you actually don't understand what, you don't understand in detail the underlying cost of what you're selling is, right? So none of us could put our hand on our heart and say, we know exactly what the outcome will be in terms of TPD costs over the next 5-10 years. You can say the same about disability income. You can say the same about workers' compensation claims or professional indemnity claims. So where there's not a great understanding of that underlying cost of something, some emotion comes into making pricing decisions, essentially. So you can go through the cycle of greed versus fear, which is obviously what we went through in the cycle that happened in group insurance over the last few years. Unfortunately, reinsurers often end up at the bottom of the food chain. Now, that graph there, this isn't the APRA stats. This is actually taken from the financial accounts and trying to work back to include what the retrocession losses were. This is group and retail insurance. But this is the reinsurance cycle, if you will, since 2000. There were losses in the early 2000s, mainly related to retail individual disability income. There were profits from the period 2005-2007, and you can sort of see the big losses in the more recent years, right? And really the challenge for reinsurers is to meet shareholders' return in a very competitive but large market in Australia. It's either the second or the third, depends who you speak to, largest life reinsurance market in the world. And there's billions of dollars that all the different reinsurers have invested in this market. And if you think they need a particular return on their investment, you can see from that graph they're obviously not making that return. They're actually losing money. So it's a very challenging market to be in, and a very one of the things I'll talk about in terms of the challenge is what you need to do to differentiate yourself and be competitive in this market, but not lose a lot of money. So there's a few things in terms of how do you get there? How do you do that? And why would you be in this market if you weren't able to answer the question? And I think there's probably two key things I would point to. I think it's actually developing a proposition that delivers additional value to the propositions of insurers and trustees. Going back to the role of the reinsurer slide, and talk about the things that are now seen as important by trustees and insurers, things such as claim support, pricing expertise, all those sorts of things. Reinsurers need to continue, and they're doing a better job of this now than they were 5 years ago, continue to invest in that part of the business so they do actually have a genuine comparative advantage, if you will, and a genuine reason for a trustee or an insurer to select them over another insurer. And also achieving sustainable pricing and product terms, which aim to achieve a reasonable return on invested capital. That sounds pretty easy, right? It sounds very obvious. It's not the easiest thing to do when you don't understand the underlying trends, the underlying factors that are actually driving the experience of the fund and projecting those into the future. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in the next slide as to how to possibly avoid that as a reinsurer. Another point, I think this is probably something that Jeff touched on the other day, but super returns and substandard returns are not sustainable. So a market where you're actually cutting your margins down to the bone and potentially losing money like we had before, that's not a sustainable market. But on the other hand, overpricing for long periods of time isn't sustainable either. Really what the challenge for reinsurers is to try and look for a sustainable return on capital that's commensurate with the actual risk that you're taking on and achieves a reasonable return for the capital you've injected into the business. Obvious stuff, very much more difficult to do than to say. So what are the key obstacles to success? And this is my last slide, so I've caught up a little bit of time. Sorry, Jeff. Sorry. I did say you had 5 minutes at the end. So I do think one of the key obstacles to success is us as reinsurers rebuilding trust. I think we've lost some of that. We lost that in the boom bust cycle that happened in 2013, 2014 in particular. We've lost our place with some trustees and sometimes insurers as trusted advisors. Insurers have got more and more qualified teams than they may have had a number of years ago. I think reinsurers need to be able to rebuild that trust as being trusted advisors to the market. There are a number of companies, people that also provide, obviously, advice, but reinsurers need to be part of that advice model as well. And reinsurers are willing to back up their advice, obviously, with a lot of capital if a company wants to take their advice. Another one, and this probably gets a little bit to what Greg was talking about, but there's an increasing appetite of insurers and funds for insurance risk. And that's a risk for reinsurers and a challenge for reinsurers in this market. Take the example, you think of the market as it is now, as it was a number of years ago. You've got more and more foreign-owned players with very big balance sheets, whether they be Japanese or based in Hong Kong, for example, who have a lot of appetite for risk. You also have funds. These funds are enormous. Hugh Super's enormous. The Australian Supers of the world, they're enormous as well. They may get appetite for risk over time, and that obviously would be a very challenging and very market-changing move for insurers and reinsurers in this market. QInsure is an interesting one in that you're almost a fund that actually was running insurance anyway and have just got their license, essentially. So a little bit of a different model for a fund that actually has no business at all and doesn't do insurance to one that gets their license. But that's a challenge, and if we as insurers and reinsurers can't show what our value proposition is to those clients, that's a risk for both of us and a challenge for both of us in this market. Most obvious one, I guess, is the key obstacle is a return to unsustainable high and low product terms. And I think there's a couple of parts to this, right? There's the undisciplined or emergent pricing. I'll give a good example of how I see emergent pricing work, and put my sort of actuary hat on here for a moment. Best estimate should be a 50% chance of making or losing money, right? It shouldn't be padded, it should just be a best estimate. And your load margin on top of that margin should be commensurate with the amount of capital you need to hold to hold that risk, and also for a reasonable return on that capital. So you've got your best estimate of margin above that. One of the disciplines that I don't think we have a lot as an industry is a company comes back to you and says, okay, well, you've got the business, but you need to be 7-8% cheaper. One thing you could do is go through your best estimate, and you've got, okay, let's say I've made 30 decisions. I'll go through each of those 30 decisions, and I've got 10 here which are probably a little bit conservative, so I can pull them down by a couple of percent. The other 20 I'll just won't look at. That's got to be a biased outcome, right? You're just trying to convince yourself of something because you just want to get to a particular point, and you're going to sort of say, well, that's now my new best estimate. Those biases in pricing are very common, right? And I think one of the problems is that people don't sometimes come up with a genuine 50-50 best estimate. If someone gives me a best estimate and says, oh, how comfortable are you? And I say, oh, I'm pretty comfortable with it. It's probably not a best estimate, right? So and you go through that cycle of convincing yourself and going there. So that's one thing I think the industry actuaries could actually do a bit better. The other one that's a little concerning is the role of some of the offshore reinsurance. Now, to be honest, I haven't seen too much of this, but we do get visits, obviously, as everyone else does, from APRA and others, talking about product sustainability in the market. Obviously, the market has come, it still needs to go further in terms of making products which are affordable and which are not de-risked but have the appropriate amount of risk and don't invite too much anti-selection. One of the concerns is the ability potentially for offshore reinsurance to actually make it a very difficult competitive environment for a locally authorised reinsurer who is being risk-conscious, etc., around that piece. And I sort of see offshore reinsurance, I don't see that much at the moment, but there are more and more players coming into the market. And I think that's a challenge for locally regulated reinsurers who are trying to do the right thing from a product perspective. The lack of data, and actually, there's on very well the next presentation, actually. The more and more we can understand the underlying risk, the less and less our decisions are going to be more judgmental or emotive, and the more confidence we can have in coming up with a price and terms that are sustainable. One of the great things that came out of the apocalypse, if you will, was essentially insurers and reinsurers were able to get more and more data. We actually had a better bargaining position than in the pre-apocalypse period where trustees basically said, well, no one else has asked that data, so we're not going to give it to you because it takes us a while to get it from our administrator, etc. Nowadays, trustees are providing that data. Membership listings, you can actually get quite regularly as opposed to, in some cases, seeing once every 4 or 5 years in the pre-apocalyptic period, right? And it was never right in the first place. So getting more and more data will help us with that. But one of the concerns is going back to the old habits. Obviously, the APRA change, the SPS 250s, obviously help with that as well. But we as reinsurers and insurers need to keep pushing to make sure we are getting the data that we need to try and get more and more clever and sustainable in our pricing. And I can't remember what I was going to say at this last point. Forgetfulness. I think I was. But I'll put up a little quote here. So I think all of us here have been actually involved heavily in the group market the last sort of 5-10 years, know a lot of the issues that happen in the market, know what we do differently. I certainly know what I'd do differently if I had my time again. And forgetting that or not getting new people into profession and reminding them of some of the learnings that we've had could lead to the same outcome. So I've got a Mark Twain quote. So history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. Jeff Summerhayes said that to me last time I saw him, so I thought, if there's anyone from APRA here, which there is, I probably should put it in. But it's an important lesson to learn, but make sure others, when they're coming into the industry, learn the lessons from us. And that was all. Thank you.
Thanks very much. So today I want to talk about group insurance and data analytics. And that is a difficult term to refer to, given, I guess, the past of not having as much data as people would like. But what I'm really trying to share with you three things. One is somewhat the difficulty that we face in group. The second is what can we do with what we have? And lastly, try and show some actual examples of what we've been doing at TAL and I guess some of the other insurers too, to really try and show more practical side of data analytics rather than some of this theoretical view we often hear, big data and analytics. But I want to actually show you today some real examples of what we can do and the way in which that's starting to enhance our understanding of the risk in group insurance. So I'm going to do that through showing you a couple of pictures, basically, rather than any numbers. But what I'm going to kind of show you that in the group we have really a data dilemma. Retail and direct, they go through an application process where you get a whole bunch of information about the person, all the way from the advisor, the sales channel, through to individual details like marital status and income and many things. Whereas in group, you might only get things like a unique identifier, the age, the gender. If you're lucky, you get a postcode or some sort of address identification. Maybe the division where they were sold in, some sort of rough occupation type data. Again, if you're lucky, you get some fund data to try and use for some analytics. Contributions or salary data, also again, if you're very lucky. And then typically the death, TPD and IP type, some assureds, various fields around that. Essentially, that's very limited. What we can do is, hopefully, if we get enough membership data of the past, is try and match that with our claims data. And that was using through a unique identifier, which unfortunately isn't always available, a direct link between your membership and your claims. But where it is, you can start to try and map things against each other. So we might have now a different administrator providing different data around occupation, around the causes of the claim, and you might know things around the status, whether it's declined or accepted or in progress, and many date fields from the incurred date through to the notified date, etc. But what we can do is there's also external data sets, and I'm going to really try and elaborate a little bit on using just the ABS census data to try and show you what we can do with at least a minimum of the postcode, age, and the gender. We can also add the census data, and we've also created some custom data, which is basically summary fields from that. So what can we really do with that? Is we can look at things around risk. So we can look at, now that we are able to potentially match claims and membership together, we can try and start to use the features that you found in your membership, which is typically different from the things you get in your claims data, and try and identify which are the drivers of your risk. Also very importantly is the data checks, both in terms of administrative checks, but also in terms of trying to backfill some of the data you may not have had in the past. And lastly, around benefit design, and that could be things around your IP cover or when people are trying to change the level of sum assured. Secondly, we can use it in its voluntary campaigns or understanding the historic take-up of opt-ins or of any voluntary. And we can use other things around a needs analysis and try and do some propensity modeling around that. And lastly is really some deep dive, I guess, claims analytics. And that's both from, I guess, just really cutting and slicing in many different ways, but also trying to find the root cause of, let's say, the income protection duration of claims. So I'm planning now to go through a bit of an exercise of looking at each one of those components and say, let's look at an exact actual example of how we've used the membership claims and some enriched form of data to try and deduce some additional insights out of that. So one of the items is the risk of a person based on where they live. And I guess from general insurance, you're probably very comfortable with the fact that where you live, where you work, they work out what your general insurance risk is. So we went on a program to try and understand the location riskiness, and that was, we ended up summarizing to saying we found that the IRSAB, which is a safer index of the ABS, which is the index of relative social advantage and disadvantage, along with it, so I'll just say IRSAB going forward, is a good predictor of the risk of a member. If all you know about a member is, let's say, age, or even if you know many more things, in a way it's somewhat is a backfill. What it basically suggests is people who are disadvantaged have a higher risk than people who are advantaged, and that's for TBD is higher, and IP is moderate, and death is somewhat in the middle. And somewhat that can be related more to an occupation-type loading, is that people who live in more disadvantaged areas typically have higher manual-type labor, whereas people in advantaged areas typically have higher professional. So this is a case where if we get a membership data which is very sparse in terms of the occupation or any type of socioeconomic factors, we could use, if we had the postcode, a way of understanding what the potential spread of risk is. And this is particularly useful in smaller groups like corporates, where if you have limited data, again, you can try and infer something about the relative risk of this fund against other funds. Now, secondly, we'll look at a bit of data checks. So this example is where we received some, not salary information, SG contribution data, and in a way it was quite a dirty data set. We had, in some cases, we weren't sure what frequency was the SG contribution, whether it was a historic last contribution or a lot of information on it. But we were able to gross up that and try and kind of work out a salary, and we could use the census salary information that comes from the census. In 2011, we inflated that to try and kind of confirm that what we've done in terms of the estimate of salary is broadly accurate. Now, it also allows us to go and go back a bit, and backfill membership data in the past where we didn't get salary data, is we can look at the factors that were that we found were strong indicators of a higher or lower salary, and backfill that either through the census data or using a model on the known data that we've got for the salary. So it's really useful for backfilling salary data there. So why do we need salary somewhat? Is one of the things that, say, you didn't have this type of information, you wouldn't be able to know what is the relative affordability of this. And I've just plotted the premium divided by salary, an annual premium over annual salary, in blue, and the premium over fund balance. And what it really shows is that it's actually quite linear at the moment for this fund, I guess was an example. But younger people have low salaries, but also very low funds. So using the salary might be a better measure of what the affordability is, because as their salary as a percentage of their fund every year is a lot bigger, whereas an older person has a fund balance that's quite large, so their salary isn't as important as in terms of the deduction of the premium from that. So let's look at a third one around fund penetration. So this is a kind of plotting what the number of members of this fund, which had was quite a large fund in a specific industry, and trying to see on a kind of postcode level, or even a capital city or any level, what is their penetration as a percentage of that total of that industry. So we basically looked at the number of members in that area and divided that into the theoretical number of members of that industry. Trude was based on the census of 2011, so there were some peculiar results, but ultimately it's a good indicator of where the fund is currently got a large amount of membership or a low amount of membership. So they can use it both in looking at some sort of targeted campaigning, but also in terms of looking at your risk profile and concentration of risk in some way. We also developed an automated needs analysis. So a lot of funds, we have our default cover, but we also have a number of people taking voluntary cover. So this is a case of not of somebody who goes onto your website and looks at your needs calculators and drags and does all their clicks to find what is the needs that they need. We wanted to calculate what the need of a member was based on very limited amount of information. So given the census, we know broadly what the percentage of people who are married of a certain age and gender and location. We also know roughly the number of children in that area, and we know broadly what the amount of mortgage or rent and a few other of the expenses through the census data, we worked out a rough percentage of people's expenses that we felt were going to persist beyond a death. Let's say in the case of a married person, your home or other expenses may still continue. So we worked out what we felt was the insurance need is the present value of future expenses. And what we do with that is we somewhat visualize it in to say, well, in your current default cover, you might have $150,000, but your need based on our kind of assumption that you're either married or have children or you could be single, what is your need? And we looked at that under insurance. And this is a good visualization to show the fund and trustees to say, well, this is the automated kind of calculation. We'd like to help you to target some members who are particularly underinsured, and this is a rough estimate of what that insurance need is. And that person would then go and try and determine what their true need is through an online portal, which may be very different to the one we calculated, but at least through our campaigning, we can try and target the right kind of people. In terms of voluntary propensity, we also can use some modeling techniques. So that's using all the member data that we have, plus, I guess, in some cases, the claim data, but that's limited, in any census or other external data we did also have. And we found what were the key variables that linked to that. So in this case, it was actually an occupation, the division, the size of the fund balance, whether the person was married or not, the age, amount of salary of the person, and the gender. So, and then we can plot that onto, I guess, a likelihood of taking up of this insurance. So, and we can say to the fund, kind of, what type of targeted campaign would you like to run? If you target everybody, you're roughly going to get the exact same experience that you have now. But we can use this model to predict higher likelihoods. So in this case, if you only targeted 5%, your highest 5%, in this case, this example, we'd have that 5% would have about 18.5% chance of opting up an additional unit of cover. But let's say you targeted 20%, we might predict about 13% of people might take up that opt-up cover. So it's really about talking with the fund and saying, this is the under insurance need, this is the kind of list of members where you could target, and you would look through like an email or other type of campaign and run that campaign through there and look at the success of that. Lastly, I wanted to show a video which was basically shows in terms of claims that we do quite a lot of things around kind of deep dive specifically into income protection around the length of claim and what are the factors that drive that. So now we've got actual tables that are the termination rates. Those on aggregate are pretty good for determining what the length of a claim is. But on an individual by individual case, you might find that that case is a very specific type of cancer which has a much longer or shorter duration. So we're trying to use analytics to try and have a more accurate prediction of that. I'm just going to get that going. This is a plot of the claims specifically we're looking at a certain type of cancer claim, and we're trying to see where were the hotspots of that claim in order to try and have some sort of campaign around awareness and also influencing the way in which we manage our claims. So this is a pretty basic software, but when we come to the funds, it's really about showing them the power of the data that they provide us. If they only give us 5 fields about members once every 2 years, there's limited things we can do. So at this stage, we're really trying to encourage the funds to give us more access to more fields and more frequently, and ultimately a live stream would be what we really want to try and achieve. Because the more information we can get, the more targeted risk we can identify, and then ultimately we believe that in the long run, the pricing would be more optimal for the overall industry. So I was hoping you've enjoyed the show I've given of some of the practice things we've done, and I invite your questions on some of the things we've done today.
Well, that's great. We've had 3 very good presentations, and hopefully there is some discussion to be had. So I'll pass the session over to the floor now, and we'll take questions over the next 20 minutes. So have anyone to kick off? Questions? I have a whole stack on threatening. Peter.
Peter Tanuth, question on data analytics. Obviously, the data are held by a single fund in relation, single insurer in relation to this sort of analysis across the country is probably certainly useful for that individual book or that set of books, but possibly more useful would be a collective of all funds data and all in relation to that sort of analysis on, for example, cancer rates in different areas and so forth. Is there any moves afoot in terms of the sharing of data of this sort of nature in order to, I guess, optimise outcomes across the country as a whole?
I'm not aware of any initiatives on the from the insurers to kind of collect the information. I know there's a number of studies that are done throughout the year. I think there's some by Russ Warner and by the KPMG, but in a way that is also, I guess, limited in terms of the information they currently collect. So I would think one of those type of initiatives might be possible for some additional analytics to be performed. In the data space, there's a definite move towards a data in the cloud, I guess, among in a fairly de-identified case. It's something like a Data Republic at the moment. They're creating almost a platform for people to buy kind of data, whether it's a matching or a campaign leads or things like that, rather than going direct through to some of the consultants. You now it's starting to become an open source type database where you can kind of pay for your leads for that. But within Intel, we've got a fairly large portfolio, so we are able to look across more than one fund. But there is still some issues around different funds giving different amount of data, plus the frequency of that. In some cases, we don't get member identification, so you can't even match the claims with a lot of success or with much confidence. But and even the occupation definitions, there are a lot of things that are not standardized across the data that you do hold. And that's where some of the external data enrichment that we can try and achieve would be quite powerful. But certainly from my side, I'd encourage any activity to try and collate and get data for everybody.
Thank you. Any more? Well, I'll ask one on data anyway. we've spent a lot of time trying to get data better and better. How are you finding that, Daniel, in your work? Is it improving, and what? You know, how far have we gone in terms of getting just basic good claims data, for example?
I guess I've been here 1 year now in Australia, and I would describe the group environment to be data poor still. In that, as I mentioned before, retail and direct, they have fairly large amount of information about their members, both through the sales process and through regular client interaction. So, from a profiling type of perspective, the group data is fairly poor still. Some of the other issues is around retrospectively looking at the data is where there's some issues. So there are funds that provide probably sufficient amount as of today's date, but being able to do your claims analysis on the same factors retrospectively is not possible if you don't have the data on the same source over time. But there is definitely a lot more moves towards getting data, external data, and I do believe if there was some way of getting almost an agreement that we can get personalized information a lot easier, that would be a lot easier for us as an insurance industry, rather than having to rely upon de-identified, really weakens the amount of analysis we can do.
Chair from Commission, I have a question for Greg. Thank you for the presentation. I thought it's a very brilliant and bold strategy that you have for QInsure. My question is, the market is changing now again, and what's the contingency plan for QInsure if your assessment criteria now starts to move towards your insurers and not so much on QInsures, and especially you're not participating in a wider group insurance market as well?
Sure, it's a good question, and it was certainly one contemplated going in. So, in essence, the trustee obligations remain the same to kind of make sure that value is there for members, and then they will look to the market in that sense over time. So actually entering the arrangements, exit plans for both entities were put in place. So in essence, if for some reason the trustee got to a point it shows that Q Insure's purpose wasn't needed any further, there's actually an exit plan in place. Ultimately, a trustee controls that exit plan through policy termination anyway. But naturally, I guess Q Insure or Q Super Group will continue to kind of evolve and monitor market and take its strategy and view along. So hopefully we don't see that scenario arise, but it's certainly been contemplated. Do I cover what you're after?
Yeah, in high level, yeah.
Yeah, look, obviously the plan drills down to things such as, well, what do you do with the resources? Obviously, you need to run off that kind of scenario. So if an insurance policy goes into runoff, you need to deal with that. We would have had to deal with that anyway as a trustee had we externally insured. So in that sense, it's there. Obviously, the returns and capital and shareholder pieces will play out in that sense. But, I guess there is a fully contemplated plan. I haven't gone through all the detail. But, yeah, hopefully we don't get that one arise any time soon.
Any other questions? Here we go.
Wayne Brazel. So as we move more and more down the track of data analytics, but particularly around assessing the risk more accurately and at a granular level, what do you see as the future of group risk as you start getting selection away from the pooling into the more granular? So are you going to get left with all your poor risks that become unaffordable?
I think it's for me. I guess I'll give you my personal view. As Andrew mentioned on the reinsurance, group insurance is a very efficient market. We have about 80% to 90% loss ratios. So it's a very efficient way of distributing products. So I do believe it's a personal view that the long run that insurance should be sold through superannuation as its primary source without the heavy involvement of advisors. So that would be through advanced analytics on people so that you can get a lot more price-sensitive rating basically through their process, a very similar process to currently in retail and direct where you use the information to price people more appropriately in the same way you currently price people in the retail environment or direct environment with more factors. Not only that, I also believe that more health information and personalised information of people will be used to price people. So you're likely to get a very high range of premium rates even in the group environment. I don't see that happening in the default space for some time, but definitely in the voluntary and any fixed set cover setting, I do think there's a lot of scope to provide a more retail-like product and pricing, but at a much more competitive price because of the lack of advisor involvement in that. And I do think data is the future, and analytics on that is the driver of insurance going forward.
So I've just said something more from the trustee perspective. So one of the issues we looked at, in essence, was down this track as a trustee, and we actually asked our members, what's their view? How would they like to be treated? They certainly want a breadth of product, but they also told us they all wanted to be treated the same. And obviously that leans into the default cover scenario. But, it's something for the trustees, and I think for insurers to think from their perspective as to how is the trustee going to work, to understand its membership and what its expectations are. Does it want a whole lot of retail products priced at all different ranges, or does it see value in blended kind of member rates or product rates? And the key becomes understanding how each segment's performing and then being able to inform the trustee or the policyholder, hey, this area is performing better or worse. But being able to then make informed decisions, do you want to still run more generic rates or more personalised rates and how far you take those kind of things. So very much comes back to what's the fund strategy in that sense? Does it want to be totally individualised with whole sets of rates, or does it want to stay more blended in that sense?
I'll just add to that. I can see definitely trustees is definitely a challenge at the moment, because in some cases we don't even have unisex rates, not even kind of gender specific rates. So we've gone completely the opposite direction in that space up to this point. So there's initially is a challenge even to bring in kind of fairly accepted insurance pricing differentials. To take that beyond into the next level, that will definitely take some time and some convincing of the merits behind that. And that's why I see the default not really changing for some time. But ultimately, I do really think it's the most efficient distribution platform. So that's why I would think we should sell insurance.
Question for Andrew, perhaps? here we go.
What would be some of the emerging risks for the group market?
I'll take this one. Look, there's a number of them I touched on, I suppose. One is going back into that cycle. So again, it's a very large market. There's still a lot of growth gap in that market. Over exuberance is something that insurers and reinsurers have been guilty of in the past, and markets go through cycles, right? We went through one very big cycle. So making sure we don't go down that over-exuberant path again. That can also incorporate, you know, foreign capital coming into the market, et cetera. That's obviously a challenge as well for insurers and reinsurers. In terms of other things, there's the more obvious things. I mean, I think that the lawyer involvement's being talked about a fair bit. My view is that the lawyer involvement's picked off a lot of the low-hanging fruit. And we have actually adjusted a lot of the product terms reasonably. But I've taken in terms of the biggest emerging risk, which actually comes from that, is the things that APRA have been talking about more recently. The concern that too much of retirees or future retiree superannuation contributions are getting pulled out into the insurance market. And we've gone through so many rate increases over the last number of years that what used to be a small percentage of a superannuation contribution is now becoming a pretty sizable proportion and a pretty sizable hit to people's retirement incomes. If a view of ASIC or the government is such that the industry needs to do something about that, otherwise they'll look to change the arrangements, that would be a big issue for the industry. And we've gone through product development up to a point. We've, for want of a better term, de-risked a lot of the TPD products. But I do think we need to go further, because the cost, this cost of the superannuation contribution, or the money going into insurance, I think in general, is still too high. It varies by fund. And I think that's the challenge of the next 5 years, to make sure we can continue to operate as we're operating, albeit on smaller premiums and better terms. Who else want to?
Look, I think cover good guy. I agree the awareness could definitely still increase in the market, even though I guess the lawyers have knocked off the low-hanging fruit. If you look at the incident rates that QSuper has, they're quite high relative to perhaps the market. Rates in its membership, and that's because our employers are highly engaged, so it's the employers actually initiate a lot of the claims. So I think that is definitely a risk for the more major multi-sector funds that perhaps don't have that engagement. Agree with Andrew, trustees are thinking about what's the spend and how much and what relativities are. I think one thing there, though, is rates have gone up a lot, but they went down a lot before that, so relatively they're probably what they were in the early 2000s. But what happened was the trustees fed discounts into more cover, so we're spending more as a result of that. So relatively the rates might be the same, but we're spending more because we bought more cover, and it's hard to take cover away once you give it. But I have seen trustees reviewing those defaults a little bit around that front as well.
Do we have another question?
Question for Greg, please. So I guess as part of Q Insure and your ownership being trustees, I'm just interested in the sources of capital that the trustees can access, because it operates very differently to a company, to a listed company, where they can access share markets and bonds and whatever. I guess I sort of ask this because 20 years ago, companies demutualised and had to sort of go through a path, some for capital reasons, etc. So, yeah, just interested in the capital sources of trustees.
Sure. So I can't talk for other funds where they might source capital from, obviously, but for QSuper's perspective, QSuper was funded from its reserves. It had substantial reserves in place. And obviously, I guess one of the considerations in funding that was an appropriate return on capital for that money being put in essence is it's not all insured members' money in that sense. So it definitely took an assessment of that relative to the commercial returns of the insurers over time. So we took a long-term, 10 to 15-year view, I think, of that work that was done. So obviously the profits then are returned to the members through obviously return to the shareholder, and then the shareholder will work through what are the options best to distribute that. It might be reinvestment elsewhere or whatever. But I think obviously any other fund looking at it would need to look to what are its sources and how will it make that decision around what members' best interests are and isn't a return on capital appropriate. Did that cover what you're after?
Any more? I've got one for Andrew because I'm interested in my question. The you talk about value add from reinsurers and trustees are hungry for advice. There's no doubt about that. But ultimately, under the current structure, your client is the insurer. So when I talk to some of my trustees, we're thinking about the reinsurer having a direct relationship with the trustee as well as the insurer. So take away that. Because at the moment you're conflicted, how would you feel about a direct relationship?
So I can also talk about our model. We do strive to have the direct relationship with the trustee as well. It's been interesting how different insurers have actually either appreciated or not. Some of them like you being in the tent and like us being almost the trusted advisor that they've brought along to the discussion and often having different views and put it all together and come to the trustee and say, this is our considered position. And so a lot of trustees, I do think, value that. You do get some insurers that do see it as a threat. In terms of are we going to go and work with somebody else and take some of their insights and so forth, I'd say that's in the minority. But I really do think if you don't have that relationship with the trustee, you're always going to be the bottom of the food chain. And the trustee is the person making the ultimate decision. You need to be sort of part of that value add for the trustee. And that's why we as a company try and do that as much as we can.
Well, I think our time is up. Is there another question? Very good.
Look, I'll make it really quick. Greg, you touched on quite a number of interesting points as to where Q Insure could add value relative to, what you're being offered by the life insurers. So you had timeliness and service, the relationship with the employers, the claims management philosophy, I think not meeting benefit terms, the delegations and price. So I was just wondering, in terms of the people here interested in trying to prevent the next Q Super, was there any there that surprised you or that should be, easily to focus on, which ones are harder or easier to deal with for an insurer?
Yeah, sure. I think, again, you've got to try and stand in the trustee's shoes and say what's their strategic objectives, what are they trying to achieve, which will typically be about retirement adequacy, retaining its members and growing for the benefit of all members. And so when it designs out its product, it's designing that out with its intent. So, product seems to be step one from my perspective would be looking at how do I actually support the product they're trying to achieve. And work through the differences, which I think insurers have shown an appetite to do. But it becomes a pretty big differentiator. Like there were things that for us just weren't negotiable, such as moving away from unlikely to unable or prevented from ever in the TPD regime was something we weren't willing to do. And so I think there are elements when you've got a big book of experience that says you performed in that product. Why try and force it away? And the feedback we're getting from reinsurers that had done work in that space was when they retrospective look at claims, they were finding there was no difference. But obviously how we apply that term going forward could drive quite a big difference in that sense. There's efficiency in how you drive that efficiency between the fund and the insurer, who's got the best relationship with the member and the claimant, to employer. How do you get that information and how you work through that? And I think we are seeing more flexibility in that space as well. But the big differentiators were around that product. We felt we were clearly superior on that claims management kind of turnaround. We felt that was a material risk, obviously, given that. And that flowed onto a further pricing risk if in fact that deteriorated. But I think there's absolute kind of opportunities to create additional value. I mean, we didn't have the technology around straight through, processing and underwriting elements. There's definitely partnership opportunities, but I think you've got to come back to what's the trustee trying to do? It's a partnership, but it's a partnership to achieve the trustee goals, and and why, what's driving why they want to go where they are, and can you get there? Does that answer it?
That's one thing. I think it's one thing about a fund going by itself, and you think about sort of in terms of sort of capital margins and logic. If you compare a fund sitting by itself and you're looking at a 1 in 200, 200-year scenario versus a diversified book of business, you might have a different view as to what those capital margins need to be and how much capital you need to hold against it. So that's got to be part of the pricing thinking as well. How much capital am I holding versus how much is a diversified insurer or reinsurer having to hold?
Agreed.
You might all have different return.
Okay, well, it's 2 o'clock, so thank you for all your participation, and I'd like to thank our 3 speakers, Daniel, Greg and Andrew.